one of the following superpowers. Which superpower would you choose? A, super strength. B, super speed. C, invisibility. Or D, the ability to fly. So by show of hands, who would vote for super strength? Okay, a few of you. Who would choose the speed? Again, Dave Sadler. Invisibility, anyone? Okay, you are a sneaky lot of people, all you invisibility people. How about the ability to fly?
Amen.
Yeah, everyone wants to fly. So in a culture like ours that has dedicated hundreds of movies to the superhero or thousands of comic books to the superhero, we like to focus on that superhuman being who has superhuman powers, but it doesn't really matter who the superhero is or what their superpower is. The one thing that all of these people have in common is superhuman ability to control outcomes. To stop things from happening, to make other things happening. They can stop bad guys or bad girls from doing whatever they have in mind to do. They can save people from burning buildings. They can avert nuclear meltdown or whatever the case may be. When I was young, I dreamed about what it would be like to be a superhero, but you get older. And those dreams get pushed into the realm of fantasy. But the desire to control outcomes never really goes away, does it? If we had superpowers, then we could protect ourselves or the people that we love. If we had superpowers, we could turn back time, like Superman. We could fly backwards in time and get to that moment of our greatest mistake and redo it all. If we had superpowers, we could finally get what we want. Or steer away from what we're afraid of. The temptation to manipulate, to maneuver, to control, tends to surface in the places of our greatest fears or in the place of our greatest desires. And so the person who is terrified of rejection often will use emotional manipulation to keep the people they love close on a leash. Or that person who has a burning desire to get to the top of the heap, they'll do whatever it takes, stepping on people all along the way as long as you get to the top. So my question for you this morning is, what are your great desires? Or what are your great fears? Where are you most likely to maneuver, to manipulate, and attempt to control the ends? Now, last Sunday, we looked at the life of Abraham, and we said that his life was marked by faith, by testing, by sacrifice. This morning, what we're going to do is we're going to look at the life of his grandson, Jacob. Jacob's life was marked by deception, manipulation, and control. And I've been praying all week that as we consider his life, that God would give us the grace to consider our own. And whether or not our life falls into the way of Jacob, or whether it really aligns with the way of Jesus. Jacob's story begins before he was born. His future parents, Isaac and Rebekah, were childless. They were concerned that they couldn't conceive. And so Isaac prayed to God on behalf of his wife, and God granted his prayer, and Rebekah conceived. But her pregnancy was a difficult one. Or at the very least, she felt like there was something abnormal going on. And she lived in a time before ultrasound, and so all she had was to cry out to God. And she did. She said, God, what's going on inside my womb? And God spoke to her, and this is what he said, Genesis 25. Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment, so they named him Esau. Esau means hairy. After this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob. I think any mom who finds out that she's carrying twins is surprised, really surprised. Rebecca was. But she was also surprised by God's prophetic word. The older will serve the younger. Jacob and Esau were born into a culture that functioned according to the principle of primogeniture. Essentially, what this principle stated was that upon the death of the father, the oldest son would become automatically the head of the family, and when it came to the inheritance, he would receive a double portion of the inheritance. This was the eldest son's birthright. And so, what this practice did, in essence, was it destined the oldest son to significant privilege and advantage, and it destined every other son to disadvantage. But here, God reverses the order. The older will serve the younger. What God means by this phrase is all of those incredible promises given to Abraham, land, descendants, blessing, honor, nation serving him, all of those blessings that had been passed on to his son Isaac were now to be passed on to the younger son, Jacob. So we're told that Rebekah went into labor. Esau was born first, but Jacob followed quickly behind. In fact, he came out of the womb, grabbing on to his brother's heel. The name Jacob literally means he grasps the heel, but this word is a Hebrew idiom. What it means is he takes advantage of, or he's a deceiver. That's the name that Jacob bore. And it turns out the way that Jacob entered into this world shaped the way that he made his way through this world. He was a schemer to the core. And the next couple seasons in his life makes it abundantly clear. The first thing that we see Jacob do is steal his brother's birthright in chapter 25, verse 27 and following. Esau and Jacob may have been twins, but they weren't anything alike. Esau, when it came to his physical appearance, was big and strong. He was hairy. Jacob was smooth. Esau was wild. He was brash. He was unsophisticated. He lived in the moment. He was driven by his desires. He fought with his stomach. But Jacob was calculated. He was sophisticated. He was shrewd and conniving. He always had an eye on the future. And so while his older brother was big and strong, Jacob bided his time, and he waited for the moment when he could use his wits to fool his dim-wit brother. And the day came. Esau was out hunting in the open country, as he liked to do, and he came back in from a hunting trip exhausted, famished, and he found his brother Jacob was cooking stew. Esau hadn't thought ahead. He hadn't brought enough to eat or drink with him, and when he came back into his family's camp, he was exhausted and ready to collapse. And Jacob, being Jacob, seized the moment and took advantage of his brother's weakness. This is what we read, verse 30. Esau said to Jacob, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished." Jacob replied, "First sell me your birthright." "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. "What good is the birthright to me?" But Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So Esau swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank and then got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. So we have this prophetic word. Before they were born, the older will serve the younger. But what we're not told is how this reversal was meant to happen. How would God bring it about? Jacob was not a wait for God to work kind of God. He was a make it happen on my own kind of God. And he was so busy trying to secure God's promises through his own means and his own efforts, he had no opportunity to allow God to work. And that's what happens when all of us live a life of control and grasping. There's neither time nor space for God to give us anything because our fists are clenched. Grasping, scheming, taking, this is the way of Jacob. Is it your way? Is it my way? Well, Jacob wasn't done after he had stolen the blessing. After he stole the birthright, there was still the blessing to steal. The day came when his dad, Isaac, fell ill. He was getting old, he was blind, he wasn't sure how much longer he had, and so he called Esau to his bedside, and this is what he said. "I'm now an old man, and I don't know the day of my death. Now then, get your equipment, your quiver and bows, and go out into the open country to hunt some wild game for me. Prepare me the kind of tasty food I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may give you your blessing before I die." Now, there's two things wrong with this picture. The first, this discussion of the blessing, This conversation between Jacob, between Esau and Isaac, it's a secret meeting. In the ancient world, family blessings weren't ever done in secret. It was a huge family affair. Everyone gathered. Everyone was in on it. Not here. It's just the two of them, scheming. Now here's the thing. Isaac didn't know that his wife, Rebecca, was right outside the tent and listening to everything he was saying. And so when she heard his scheme, she came up with one of her own. First problem, secret meeting. Second problem, Isaac's decision to bless Esau is in clear violation of the word God had already spoken all those years before. The blessing in question is the promise that God gave to Abraham. The promise of land, descendants, blessing, honor. God had made things abundantly clear before these boys were born that the older would serve the younger. But Isaac had his own plans. Esau's the oldest. Esau's my favorite. Esau will get the blessing. So after Rebekah heard her husband's plan, and after Esau was sent out with bow and arrow, she quickly grabbed Jacob and she spelled out a plan. She said, "Jacob, I know the kind of food your father likes. I've been cooking for him for decades. I can prepare it before Esau returns from the open country. Your father is as blind as a bat. The two of you boys, your voices sound remarkably similar. If you bring in the food I prepare, he'll think it's your brother Esau. Play along with my scheme." Now, if Jacob had been a different sort of man, he would have refused outright. But instead, his response reveals he wasn't concerned about the morality of his mother's plan. His only concern was, will it work? Will I get caught? He played his mother's scheme to perfection. And he duped his blind father, telling lies with practiced ease. After eating the food, Isaac called Jacob to come near, thinking it was Esau, and this is the blessing he pronounced. "May God give you heaven's dew and earth's richness, an abundance of grain and new wine. May the nations serve you and peoples bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may the sons of your mother bow down to you. May those who curse you be cursed, and those who bless you be blessed." After receiving this incredible blessing, Jacob made a very hasty exit, and we're told that moments later, Esau came in. And when he discovered what his brother had done in his absence, he made a vow, "I'm going to kill him." And so this scene ends with Isaac and Rebekah grabbing Jacob and saying, "You have to run for your life because your brother is going to kill you." And out Jacob ran. The next chapter of Jacob's story is really one in which he was interrupted by God. Jacob was fleeing from his brother. He ran all day and into the night, and as sun began to set, he needed to find some place to sleep. And not having anything with him, he laid down, he pulled up a stone, and he used it as a pillow. And that night, he had a dream in which he saw the stairway reaching from earth to heaven, with angels ascending and descending. And at the top of the stairway, we read that he saw the Lord, and the Lord spoke to Jacob, saying, "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and I will give you and your descendants the land on which you were lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I'm with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I've done what I promised." Incredible. Jacob awoke from his sleep the next morning, and he thought to himself, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware." And how many of us have had that same kind of experience, where we wake up one day, we're feeling alone, perhaps destitute, and God breaks in, and we say to ourselves, "God must be here." Well, the thing is, God is not a geographically bound deity. It's not as though he's in some places and in other places he's absent. God is everywhere, all of the time. There's no such thing as a God-forsaken place or situation or relationship. We can count on God's presence. So Jacob took this stone he'd been laying on, this pillow, and he made it into a pillar, an altar, if you like, to God. And this is what he promised to God. He said, "God, if you will be with me, and will watch over me on this journey I'm taking, and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear, so that I return safely to my father's household. Then the Lord will be my God, and this stone I've set up will be God's house, and of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. Have you ever known what it is to be running scared in life? To be alone, to be desperate, afraid? Jacob had swindled Esau out of both birthright and blessing, but in light of what had happened, in light of him being on the run, he had no hope he was ever going to see what he had swindled Esau out of. This was the darkest moment of his life, and his ability to outmaneuver others had just blown up in his face, and it's at this moment, at his lowest, that God chose to reveal himself. There is something about our desperation that opens us to God. Isn't that right? When we're feeling desperate, alone, incapable, we are reminded that we can't control most of what happens in this world. And perhaps we might actually need to rely on the God of the universe. So God comes to Jacob. He reaffirms all the promises that were made to his grandfather Abraham, but he adds three personal promises. He says, Jacob, I'm with you. You might feel like you're alone and you're moving into the unknown, but I will go with you wherever you go. Two, I will watch over you. This is the promise of protection. And three, I will bring you back. It's a promise of redemption. The promise of homecoming. Now, most of us probably haven't had dreams like Jacob had. It's pretty profound. And yet what we discover is this profound encounter with God does not leave Jacob immediately changed overnight. He's had decades to live in the way of maneuvering and manipulating and deception, and it's going to take some time. Notice Jacob's response to God. He says, if you do what you promised, then you will be my God. Now, up until this point, Jacob hadn't trusted anyone but himself. But in this moment, this encounter with God opened Jacob to the possibility of trust, and his heart opened just a crack. And as we discover in Jacob's story, it would take a lot more hardship for the door to swing open wide so that his heart was finally ready to bow before God. Let's take a look at the third chapter of Jacob's life, beginning in chapter 29. Now, there's all kinds of principles that God spells out in the scriptures, principles to live by. Some are brilliant, some are scary. This one is scary. Galatians 6:7 spells out the principle of reciprocity. A person reaps what they sow. And we've all seen this work in the natural world. And so if you plant an apple seed and put it in the ground, the apple seed, more often than not, is going to grow into an apple tree. If you take an oak seed and put it in the ground, you're going to get an oak seed. If you blow on a dandelion, all of these beautiful seeds will spread all over your green yard, and up will come all kinds of dandelions, right? Well, what's true in the realm of agriculture is true in the rest of life. Fear begets fear. Anger begets anger. Violence, more often than not, begets violence. It's the principle of reciprocity. We reap what we sow. Jacob had been sowing deception and manipulation for decades. And up until the death threat from his brother, he had skated through life relatively unscathed. But all of that was about to change. Jacob was about to meet his match in the manipulation department. And he was going to learn the hard way now through his future father-in-law. Laban was a master manipulator, and for the next 20 years, he suffered through Laban's tricks and deceptions and control. Finally, what Jacob had done to others was visited on him. Now, we're not going to read through chapters 29 and to 31, but let me spell out the abridged version. Jacob arrives in Paddan Aram, and he's welcomed by his extended family. He meets Laban, he's welcomed into his home, and one of Laban's daughters, Rachel, he was just love-struck from the moment he saw her. And he wanted to marry her. But he had nothing. He had left home penniless. He had no bride price to pay to his father-in-law, and so Jacob offered to work for Laban for 7 years. Now, guys, those of you who are thinking about buying an engagement ring, you know, the rule of thumb is 3 months' salary or something like that. Can you imagine 7 years? Scripture tells us that Jacob said she was worth every last hour. 7 years went by like it was a day, and when the 7 years had come up, a big wedding feast was thrown. And in the ancient world, wedding feasts were huge. They lasted for days. There was food, there was dancing, and there was drink. There was lots and lots of drink. And we're meant to understand that what Laban did is he took advantage of his son-in-law's drunkenness. And on his wedding night, he presented to Jacob a very veiled bride that was not Rachel, but was her older sister, Leah. And the next morning, Jacob woke up and he rolled over and there was Leah at his side. He felt foolish. He was furious. He was probably really hungover. He had been manipulated by his father-in-law. And when he confronted him, Laban downplayed the whole deception. He said, hey, listen, in our culture, it's common to have the oldest sister married first. Of course you can marry Rachel too, but it'll cost you another 7 years of service. You reap what you sow. Scripture says God will not be mocked. He will not be mocked. Jacob had taken advantage of his own father's blindness to steal his father's blessing. Laban used the veil, the drink, and the darkness of night to blind Jacob to the switching of the brides. And for the next 20 years, Jacob had to swallow this long and bitter taste of his own medicine. The final scene we're going to look at this morning comes from Genesis 32. Jacob now has multiple wives. He has a huge family, and he senses it's time to leave Laban and go back to my home country, to Isaac, Rebekah, and to Esau. When Jacob had run away 20 years ago, he was a single man. He had nothing. 20 years later, he was going back with wives, with family, with massive wealth, but there was an uncertainty in the return home. What would Esau do? There's no way my brother's forgotten what I've done. What I don't know is whether he's going to exact revenge. And so Jacob sent some messengers to prepare Esau. Your brother is coming home, and the messengers returned to Jacob with the following message. Esau is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. It's not a welcome party. It's an army bent on destruction. And so Jacob looks at his way, manipulation, deceit, control, and he concludes, I can't outmaneuver a 400-man army. Jacob did the only thing he could think to do. He divided his family and flocks into two groups, thinking to himself, if Esau attacks one group, then maybe the other group will make their way free and escape. But he had no confidence in his plan, and with nowhere else to turn, Jacob, the planner, becomes Jacob the prayer. Genesis 32, 9 to 12. Jacob prayed, O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, Lord who said to me, go back to your country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper. I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you've shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan River, but now I've become two camps. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I am afraid he will come and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, I will surely make you prosper, and I will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted. And this is a Jacob we don't recognize. No plan, no scheme. There's this humility about him. He says, I'm unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you showed me. 20 years earlier at Bethel, God made him a promise. I'll be with you. I'll watch over you. I'll make sure you return. And here he was on the verge of return, facing an army. But all that God had promised had come to pass. There was nothing left for Jacob to do than pray and hope and trust. So the next day we're told that he sent his wives and kids and flocks ahead of him. He stayed behind. We're not told why. And then there's this bizarre encounter that begins in verse 24. We read that Jacob was left alone and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower Jacob, he touched the socket of his hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, let me go for it's daybreak. But Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. The man asked, what is your name?
Jacob,
he answered. Then the man said, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, it's because I saw God face to face, yet my life was spared. The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. This is a really bizarre encounter, and it's not until it's all over that Jacob even understands what's taken place. Jacob wrestled all night with a man he couldn't outpower or outmaneuver. Jacob was outmatched, and the best thing he could do was simply hold on to him. And when daybreak came, this man touched Jacob's hip, and it was wrenched. It turns out that Jacob wasn't wrestling a mere man. He was wrestling God, and he didn't even know him. The man asked, what's your name? And Jacob was forced to own up to his name and to the behavior that had marked him his entire life. In essence, what he says is, my name's Jacob. I'm a deceiver, a manipulator, and a controller. I try to control everyone and everything. And with this confession out in the open, God says to him, no longer will you be called Jacob. You will be called Israel. Which means he wrestles with God. For you have wrestled with God and with humans and have overcome. I've only told you the first half of Jacob's story this morning, and it's a pretty dark story, filled with twists and turns. His character flaws are everywhere. I mean, who's worse, Jacob or Esau? It would be hard to choose. But if all that we see in this story is character flaw and failure, we're missing the point. The consistent thread running through Jacob's story is the faithfulness of God. When we look at Isaac and Rebekah, we see deception and division in their marriage. When we look at Jacob and Esau, we see deceit, manipulation, control. But what God saw as he saw this family was a family that he could use, a family that he loved, a family that needed redemption. And so no matter how crass Esau was or how conniving Jacob was, God was there and he was at work to heal, to provide, to show up, to bless. And in Jacob's darkest hour, God appears, promising to bless, to protect, to bring him home. See, the danger in reading these Old Testament stories is we turn them into a moral lesson. And we say to ourselves, am I supposed to be like Jacob, or am I not supposed to be like Jacob? That's not the point of this story. We're meant to read the story and notice God. What is God like? What does God say? What does God do? And so I believe Jacob's story is ultimately the story of grace. Jacob gets what he didn't earn and certainly did not deserve. Jacob's story is a story about a God who is long-suffering. God waited patiently as Jacob had to experience the consequences of all of his actions. God waited patiently for Jacob to realize the futility of trying to control life on his own terms. God waited patiently for Jacob to turn to pray, to trust, to hope, to surrender. Now, it took a lot longer than it needed to. It was certainly a lot more painful for Jacob than it needed to be, but because God loved Jacob so much, he waited and waited and waited simply. And the truth of the matter is that God is waiting for all of us, too. The temptation to maneuver, to manipulate and control tends to surface in the places where we have most fear or the places of our greatest desire. These are the places where we wrestle with God and others and ourselves. But when we finally stop wrestling God and we begin to cling to Him, what we discover is that it's been in God's heart to bless us all along. That's why He's with us. We can't receive God's blessing when we're running through life with clenched fists. We can't receive His blessing until we're broken enough and humble enough to recognize that He and He alone really has what we need. And so we come to the Lord's table this morning, remembering that the greatest danger in life is in thinking that we can make life work without God, or that we can find true satisfaction in life apart from Him. The Bible describes becoming a Christian in all kinds of ways, but in John chapter 6, Jesus describes it in terms of a coming to Him and a believing in Him. When we come to Jesus, necessarily, we have to shed all kinds of old ways of thinking and behavior. We need to leave behind self-reliance and pride or our achievements. None of us get in on life with God because of what we do or accomplish. We're invited into relationship because God is a God of mercy and love. We need to give up the notion that we can live without God and still find satisfaction. We also need to give up the notion that we can make ourselves right before God and come to the conclusion that Jesus alone, His perfect life, His perfect sacrifice on the cross, is what makes us right before God. It never depends on your effort or mine. It always depends on Christ's mercy. This holy meal provides us an opportunity to come to meet with God and to receive afresh today the love and mercy and forgiveness that all of us need. So as you come forward this morning, I want to invite you to come with your burdens and lay them down before Jesus. I want to invite you to come with your sin, anticipate, expecting to receive the forgiveness and the mercy of God. I want to invite you to come with all of your attempts to manipulate and control and deceive. And ask Jesus to open your hands so that you can receive the blessing that He has for you. God loves you. And He's waiting patiently for you this morning to turn to receive. At this time, I want to invite those who are going to be serving the elements to come and take their place. If you've not been with us before, we are going to have three stations here at the front of the church and one upstairs in the balcony. For those who are in the balcony, the elements are going to be served to my right first, on the left. Once this section has been served, then the elements will be brought over to my left so you can stay where you are. As the band begins to play, I want to invite you to come forward. And just for the sake of order, we'll come row by row, beginning with the back row and working over to the front. I'm going to turn things over to Dan. Please.